countries. An initial agreement has been reached to form a joint legal committee for this purpose.
We will be signing a memorandum of understanding on exchanging expertise and organizing workshops. Western countries claim they respect international law while they are the ones who violate it the most. This is also the situation in northeast Syria. They loot Syria's oil, wheat and cotton. Those are crimes committed against international law and UN Charter. There should be a legal deterrent. International law should be implemented.
The Iranian official also met with Syria's foreign minister Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed ways to improve the historic relations between the two countries in service of both peoples. Rahimi said political and military relations between the two countries reached their highest levels during the war on Syria, reiterating the need to bolster economic and judicial partnerships.
The main focus of my visit is proposing to form a joint legal committee between Syria and Iran and other member countries of the Resistance Alliance to create a defense line against lawsuits filed against us by the enemies, and also to legally work to force the hegemonic regimes to compensate for the losses they inflicted on Syria, especially on its infrastructure. We should demand that in international entities.
Rahimi also visited Syria's People's Assembly, where he met with its speaker, Hamoudeh Sabbagh. The top Iranian official said his country will continue assisting the Syrian people, mainly in reconstructing what war had destroyed. Syrian and Iranian officials are keen on continuously exchanging visits in a show of serious willingness to further boost bilateral cooperation in all fields. This visit aims to develop judicial collaboration to match the political strategic ties between the two states. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Rush hour, Washington, D.C. Protesters assemble for demonstrations at a busy intersection.
We want 48!
A second day of demonstrations, timed to coincide with the second day of Israeli President Isaac Herzog's U.S. visit, concluded a joint address to Congress. His reaffirmation of a binding relationship between the U.S. and Israel was not kindly received by everyone.
It's a moral imperative. As an American citizen, where $3.8 billion of our tax money is going to fund apartheid and racism, death and imprisonment for people, is something I, as an American citizen, need to speak out against.
Herzog characterized a true friendship between the allies, his relationship with the U.S. troubling to those marked upon continued human rights abuses of Palestinians.
Our people in the homeland and outside of the homeland continue to suffer from being bombed, whether it's in the Gaza Strip, or raids in the West Bank, for example, like what's happened in Jenin, or even in 48 Palestine, with what's happening, for example, in certain poor Palestinian cities.
Protesters have been standing out here for hours, temporarily shutting down this busy D.C. intersection. Passersby occasionally honk their horns to show support for the demonstrators.
These protesters are worried about several issues, including more Israeli settlements and the occupied West Bank, and a potential judicial overhaul headed by Benjamin Netanyahu's regime that could give political allies control over the appointment of judges.
Judaism is a religion of 3,000 years to be subservient to God, and Zionism is a takeover. It's a transformation to nationalism. Political, selfish, flawed nationalist movement.
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it!
Shut it down!
Observers have long accused Israel of violating human rights in the occupied West Bank. A 2021 report by Human Rights Watch said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and persecution. Colin Campbell, Washington.
Fifty leaders from the EU and CELAC countries gathered in Brussels on Monday and Tuesday in what was the first summit of its kind for 8 years. CELAC consists of 33 nations in Latin America and the Caribbean. Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, is currently CELAC president. He says the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia have brought misery to millions of citizens.
Rising prices, shortages of goods, and it's not just the war. It's the sanctions upon the war. Price of fuel, of food, borrowing of monies and so on.
Gonsalves certainly wasn't the only leader to tell EU decision makers that peace negotiations are needed to end the war in Ukraine.
La guerra de Ucrania.
The war in Ukraine must come to an end. The European Union and CELAC must, as an obligation, look for a way towards peace. We cannot live with this nightmare that any day now may see all hell break loose on all of us.
It was clearly an uncomfortable event for EU leaders as they wanted to focus on securing new energy supplies and critical raw materials in order to further isolate Russia and become less dependent on China. The visiting leaders refused to blindly follow the EU's anti-Russia rhetoric, analysts point out.
They're much more willing to call out what they see as the hypocrisy of great powers, you know, talking about other great powers and how they bully small states, given the histories of colonialism and American imperialism within Latin America.
The EU did manage to sign trade deals with Chile, Argentina and Uruguay on the sidelines of the summit. However, the relentless criticism of the 27-nation bloc support for the war continued.
The world spent $2.24 trillion to fuel the war machine that only causes death, destruction and even more hunger. This summit is a way for us to say enough with that. Another world is possible.
Not only have calls here on EU leaders to facilitate peace negotiations fallen on deaf ears, but later this week EU foreign ministers will meet to agree on ways to apply more pressure on Russia while providing additional support to Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Money in exchange for stopping Tunisians from leaving the country. That's the core of the Memorandum of Understanding sealed in Tunis on Sunday by the outgoing Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, under the supervision of the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Actually, the memorandum is rather vague on financial figures. Some media have reported that the deal is worth 1 billion euros. Others say that the figures stipulated could change according to developments on the ground. What has emerged so far is that the EU intends to provide 105 million euros to Tunis to curb irregular migration. According to the European Coast Guard agency Frontex, there were more than 100,000 illegal border crossings through the central Mediterranean last year, a 50% rise compared to 2021, with Italy struggling to cope with this surge in arrivals.
We want real equality and do not want sympathy without respect. Today we need a collective agreement on inhuman migration and on the displacement processes behind which criminal networks hide. The world has been divided in two, half for the rich and half for the poor. It is no longer possible for this monetary system to continue in the same form and content. This global monetary system creates darkness wherever it wants.
Tunisia, together with Libya, is considered one of the main gateways for asylum seekers who wish to reach European shores. The country has often been described by Western media as being in a state of financial malaise following the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, high unemployment, and a worldwide swell in commodity prices.
According to some EU leaders, Brussels should make the Cash for Migrant Control Accord with Tunisia a model for similar deals with other countries. The EU has reportedly been in talks with Egypt on a similar agreement.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbors. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable.
The EU is also willing to put on the table a substantial package of macro-financial assistance to, quote, support Tunisia's fragile economy and prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Tunisian President Saied has repeatedly rejected what he calls diktats of the international financial institutions, which have tried to persuade Tunisia to remove state subsidies on basic goods, such as fuel and bread. Saied has said these measures will only lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. Max Civili, Rome.
More than 500 Iranian enterprises and companies gathered to take part in an award ceremony that is expected to up their games and also allow them to gain a foothold in the OIC economy. Nearly 150 of them passed the quality control test to acquire four-star status, the highest defined by the Standard and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries, also referred to as SMIC.
This award, or better said, the four-star certificate, represents the highest standard of Iranian products, according to OIC member states. It will allow our companies to export their goods and services to OIC member states and also improve market conditions and competitiveness.
The standard, in terms of bring the specification of the products. If you know the, what is the products, what ingredients, what the specification of the products, you can easily trade. And this brings also international recognition of the products, and free trade will bring the, remove the barriers.
The companies that were awarded the certificate and acquired the four-star status couldn't agree more.
I believe that the true award is the trust that our customers have in our products. The fact that they believe our name stands for high-quality products, for me, is more valuable than any award or certificate.
The companies that are active in food industries definitely require international standards, and for OIC member states, the halal standard is of great importance. We tried very hard to reach this level and gain the four stars and the halal certificate.
The Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is the most important organization in compiling standards in the fields of food, health, and tourism management systems accepted by 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the most active members of the Technical Committee of SMIC. As an institute developing the necessary mechanisms in the OIC, the Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is paving the way for member states to recognize each other's standard certificates. This will in turn help to boost trade. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
As the U.S. is sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, the deadly legacy of these destructive U.S. weapons continues to take its toll on civilians in other countries, including Afghanistan. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. dropped more than 1,200 cluster bombs containing tens of thousands of bombless in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of its invasion of the country. As a result, hundreds of Afghan people were killed, wounded, or maimed forever.
It was 10 p.m. when bombardment started on our house. I was targeted with an American bomb while fleeing the bombardment. I lost my feet and my hand was injured. Since then, I have been living a terrible life.
The Taliban's official for martyrs and disabled affairs also says the U.S. war on Afghanistan has created many victims, especially from cluster bombs.
Most martyrs, disabled and maimed people registered by our administration are harmed by the U.S. indiscriminate strikes and cluster bombs. The U.S. used to claim they were targeting Taliban fighters, but their destructive war machines destroyed an entire village and left no civilian unharmed.
Military experts have warned that unexploded cluster bombs across Afghanistan are still posing a serious threat to the lives of innocent people, including school children, shepherds, and farmers.
War was ongoing in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Cluster bombs were dropped by NATO and American forces in most places. I'm sure that they're not cleared yet, especially in the outskirts of the cities, mountainous in conflict areas. They pose a serious threat to civilians there. International bodies and NGOs as well as the Taliban should solve the problem as soon as possible.
Afghan people urge the international community to prevent the use of cluster bombs globally and hold the U.S. accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. left Afghanistan 2 years ago, but its unexploded bombs are still here, posing threat to the lives of innocent people. Afghans are calling for justice and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Is
GDP a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation? Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is there for all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD Economic Outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%. The picture is the same across the whole of Europe too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced also in the old continent over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has arrived in Damascus, where he was received in an official welcoming ceremony by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks discussing bilateral relations and means of enhancing them, especially in trade exchange, transport and industry, as well as in the political field and joint efforts in fighting terror and securing their shared 600-kilometer border from security threats. Assad said this visit is an opportunity to establish institutional relations and boost bilateral cooperation. The Iraqi top official said the Iraqi people are proud of Syrians' steadfastness. The two sides held a press conference underlining the importance of collaboration to address joint challenges such as terror, drug smuggling, and water shortages.
There are challenges we face directly, mainly terrorism and cooperation in countering it. Terrorism is active due to Western support, using it as a tool to target countries adhering to its independence and national interests. Some regional countries also supported terrorism. The biggest challenge is the Syrian and Iraqi people being deprived of their share of the Euphrates water, which results in thirst, hunger, and illnesses. We also have challenges on drugs, which can destroy societies.
Assad noted that economic ties will be the focus of future discussions with the aim of overcoming the economic siege on Syria. He praised Iraq for its years-long support for Syria during the war. Al-Sudani reiterated his country's support for Syria's unity, referring to the necessity of solving the refugee situation.
Iraq's support for Syria's sovereignty and the government's control of all its territories is a matter of interest to Iraqi national security. The Syrian and Iraqi blood shed together portrays the clearest images of relations between both countries. The biggest joint challenges today are security and economy. We need more coordination. Today, we are creating mechanisms for such coordination.
Al-Sudani said Syria cannot be left alone in facing difficulties and called for lifting the unjust Western sanctions on the Arab country. He denounced the Israeli occupation of Arab lands, as well as the regime's aggressions on Syria and Lebanon. The Iraqi official is accompanied by ministers of foreign affairs and trade, as well as the deputy chief of joint operations in Iraq. The Iraqi prime minister's visit comes at a crucial time in which both countries are in a desperate need for increasing economic cooperation to overcome difficulties resulting from wars. Both states have for long suffered from Daesh terrorism, and high-level talks can strengthen joint efforts for countering terror. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Political analysts unanimously believe that the U.S. financial hegemony is about to end soon. This time, senior Russian MP Anatoly Akasakov has said that America will cease to exist as a global economic powerhouse in 10 years, and that the clock is ticking on U.S. financial hegemony. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, mounting debt and a reliance on sanctions have jeopardized U.S. credibility as an economic partner and may soon shatter its image as a global financial power. Anatoly Akasakov, the head of Duma's Financial Market Committee, told Izvestia news outlet at St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, SPIEF, recently. According to the senior lawmaker, the U.S. share in global trade turnover is rapidly dropping, a trend likely to continue in the coming years. He said, "We see that the U.S. share in the world trade has shrunk to about 70%, in part due to sanctions against Russia, which undermined confidence in the U.S. currency. Previously, 70% of international trade was serviced by the dollar. Now it is 60%. Can you imagine 10% in just a short period of time? This is significant. Naturally, this process will continue because the U.S. undermines partners' trust with their actions. So, of course, not in 1 or 2 years, but in 10 years, America, as a great financial power, will cease to exist," Akasakov added. The head of the Duma's Financial Market Committee noted that, apart from the flaws in its foreign policy, the U.S. has been plagued by problems due to its economic policies at home. He said the U.S. can, one of these days, let everyone down because effectively it cannot pay its debts. The gross domestic product it produces is less than the debts it accumulates, and whatever the country earns will not be enough to pay its debts. Meanwhile, the U.S. keeps borrowing all over the world and pays out by building up domestic debt. So eventually, there will come a time when there will be so much debt that it will become impossible to fulfill obligations, and then the U.S. economy will collapse. The U.S. narrowly avoided its first ever debt default earlier this month when President Joe Biden signed a bill that suspended the limit on Washington's $31.4 trillion in debt until January 1, 2025. This means that the U.S. government can continue to pay for services at home, such as Social Security and Medicare, by borrowing money abroad and effectively amassing even more debt. According to Reuters, Andrei Kostin, head of Russia's banking major VTB, has said the hegemony of the U.S. dollar is seriously challenged by the rise of the Chinese yuan and by Washington's failed attempts to wreck the Russian economy by weaponizing the greenback. The major banking figure said that under the current geopolitical circumstances, more and more nations are shifting away from trade settlements in dollar and euro, while China is moving towards removal of strict currency policies. The long historical era of the dominance of the American dollar is coming to an end, Kostin said in an interview with the news agency Reuters, adding, I think that the time has come when China will gradually remove currency restrictions. According to Kostin, VTB has been discussing using the Chinese national currency in settlements with third countries. He explained, China understands that they will not become world economic power number one if they keep their yuan as a non-convertible currency. Adding that it was also dangerous for the People's Republic to keep reserves invested in U.S. treasuries. The U.S. dollar has been enjoying the status of the world's reserve currency for more than a century after it managed to subsume the British pound sterling. Earlier this month, J.P. Morgan Chase analysts said the global economy is showing signs of the emergence of de-dollarization against a background of rising efforts by Asian economies to challenge the American currency's hegemony. The greenback's long-standing status as the world's dominant currency has been steadily eroded in recent years due to mounting concerns over soaring U.S. debt and widely implemented sanctions using the currency as leverage. The process of diversifying away from the greenback by countries around the world is gathering pace, according to the latest data from the International Monetary Fund. The statistics tracked by the Washington-based institution show that the dollar's share of official gold and foreign currency reserves dropped to a nearly three-decade low of 58% in the fourth quarter of 2022. The move has reportedly been gradual, and the dollar share of central banks' foreign reserves is now nearly down to a level last seen in 1995. The long-standing status of the dollar as the world's dominant currency has been steadily eroded in recent years amid concerns over soaring U.S. debt and widely implemented sanctions using the currency as leverage. The shift was more pronounced when adjusted for exchange rates, according to Stephen Jen, CEO of Eurozone SLJ Capital Limited, as quoted by Reuters. He said, What happened in 2022 was a very sharp plummeting in the dollar share in real terms, calling the decline a reaction to the freezing of half of Russia's $640 billion in gold and FX reserves. According to Jen, the drastic step sparked a rethink in countries like Saudi Arabia, China, India, and Turkey about diversifying their reserves to other currencies. The yuan's share of global over-the-counter forex transactions has increased from nearly zero 15 years ago to 7%, according to the Bank for International Settlements, BIS. After the move against Russia, other countries are questioning, what if you fall on the wrong side of sanctions? BNY Mellon strategist Jeffrey Yu told the media. He said global central banks are currently seeking to diversify their assets, scooping up corporate debt, tangible assets such as real estate and other currencies. Mark Tinker, managing director of Tosa Fund Hong Kong.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. This is the United States, and this year the country has broken a record for the number of mass killings which have taken place in just the first half of 2023. In the first 6 months of this year, 28 mass killings have taken place. But why? And is there a solution? Well, I'd like to invite my guests who are going to help me look at this overall situation on the Spotlight. Michael Beer, Executive Director, Nonviolence International, out of Washington, D.C. And Paul Sheldon Foote, academic and commentator out of Irvine, California. Thank you both for being with me. Well, I'd like to start it off in D.C. And Michael, I mean, what has changed in the United States that now there are so many more mass killings, whereas decades ago there were very few, if any?
I think that gun pollution is the primary cause. We've had a very violent society for many centuries, and the number of mass killings has particularly accelerated. AIDS. I think the major variable that has changed is the amount of guns. We are simply swimming in guns. We have at least 440 million guns in private hands in the United States, and that's not counting the millions of weapons in government hands.
Mm. Well, Paul, your perspective on that, why are we seeing an increase in the number of mass killings, it seems, every year?
Well, I disagree with him. The U.S. Secret Service did an analysis of 173 mass killings, and they said that 93% of shooters had personal issues, divorce, health issues at school or work. The problem in this country is social problems, family structure. In the 1960s, 95% of babies were born to married couples. Now 40% are born to single mothers or mothers cohabitating. Drug use. 126 million people have used marijuana, 39 million used cocaine, 28 million have used LSD, 6 million used heroin. Our social structure is going to hell. Those are the real reasons.
Mm. So you say that it's the social structure. Well, Michael, do you think in general, though, people have become desensitized to violence through the movies, through the games, which more or less has normalized violence?
To some degree, I think there has been a lot of normalization in violence in our society. It's been, of course, a very violent society for many, many centuries. This violent society has, and culture, by and large, has continued a great deal. And I think the ideas that somehow that there's more mental health problems in the United States than in other countries, that may be true to some degree, but the degree of mass killings we have here and just killings we have here is so overwhelming. And we see most of the other countries of the world not experiencing this, and yet they have many societal problems and drug problems and mental health problems too. So there's something specific beyond kind of social, cultural issues that is driving these killings.
Well, Paul, I remember when Columbine mass killing took place in 1999 at a high school in Colorado, and the whole country was just shocked. We were stunned. But do you think that the shock of these mass killings happenings have actually worn off, and now it has become a very just unfortunate part of normal life in the United States?
Yes, I do. As you mentioned previously, video games, popular with children, have massive killings in them. We have a so-called Christian minister who has written books and given speeches on why we should do a preemptive military nuclear strike in Iran and turn Iran into an ashtray. Where is the condemnation of that? We have the endless wars going on caused by us and by Saudi Arabia. Where's the outrage about Yemen and all the deaths of the people there? It doesn't register with people, and there is no outrage.
Well, let's talk about that. There's no outrage. What about that, Michael? Because what it seems that happens in the United States is that after every mass killing, there's some hoopla, and people are upset, and they put some demands on their congresspeople, and a few senators or congressional individuals will talk about it, and yes, we need to do something. The president will say this is a priority, but at the end of the day, nothing is really done, and then kind of life goes back to normal until the next mass killing. So what about what Paul said? I mean, is there a lack of consciousness or condemnation in general in the society on a day-to-day basis?
I think there's a lot of outrage and there's a lot of despair. Obviously, mass killings are happening at a huge rate, and people are frustrated because so little progress has been made. The gun industry, through its power, has been able to manipulate our public opinion and society and lawmakers in particular to stop any serious gun reduction or efforts to address this gun pollution problem. And there is outrage, there is organizing, I think there is hope, but we're a sick society. We're a sick society in a spiral where there are more killings, so buy more guns, and then there are more killings and more people buying guns, and so we have more and more guns. We are selling about 1.5 million guns a month here in this society. And so if people think it's getting worse and worse. But I do want to point out that there are people and groups that are organizing to stop this, and we have some leaders, including President Biden, who's been focused on the gun industry as the real target here, and we've really got to put a stop to the massive pollution problem we have.
Mm. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, how much is it, there's a well-known phrase that violence begets violence. And if we look at the United States and we look at whether we're talking about the roots of the United States or we're talking about the United States as being one of the main exporters of violence and upheaval in other countries around the world, Paul, how much of this has an effect back home on the overall mentality? As you had pointed out, when you're talking about bombing, whether it's Iran or Yemen or whatever, and people do not have a sense of empathy at all. I mean, Doesn't that come back home to roost, basically?
Yes, of course. I served in Vietnam in the Army, and the military learned at that point no more drafts, because when there are drafts, people protest and go against war. Ever since then, we have had volunteer armies, and the average American doesn't care. As long as they're not being sent to war, and as long as their friends aren't being sent to war, they do not care how many people we kill, how much destruction we do anywhere in the world. They don't care because it doesn't affect them. And also, please remember that 98% of the shooters in these mass cases are males. There's a good reason for that. How many families are going in America without a father present? The family structure is destroyed. And we have all these males. You don't see too many females conducting these mass murders.
Explain that a little bit more, Paul, when you say, so what is their overall higher level of frustration by the males in that society? Or what are you trying to say exactly?
Well, if you grow up in a family with only a single mother, in general, that mother is making less money, has less money to spend on you, probably can't send you to a good college. It's well documented about the higher crime rates, the lower education rates, the lower lifetime earning rates. The despair that comes out of growing up in a family like that with a single mother, and a single mother is not going to be putting the total values on that both a father and mother together would. And so we have total social decay in this country. It's a garbage pit.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
If we look at, like, the statistics, about 75% of the mass shooters are white males, are actually white males. White males in general, compared to other races in this society, usually are better off, whether we're talking about financially or whether we're talking about opportunity. So I'm just wondering, how does this all fit in? I'm still trying to get to the bulk of this. I'll throw it to Michael. I mean, what do you think? I mean, why, for example, the majority of them are male? Why the majority are white males? And why is it happening so frequently now?
It's true. Male violence is an enormous problem in the United States, in mass killings, but in general killings. Male violence is a problem that goes way back before the 1960s and 70s. And this proposition that our colleague has provided here that I disagree with, that somehow our families and our cultural life have gone down the toilet. I think that the male patriarchy is and male violence is an enormous problem that goes throughout every society in virtually in the world. All the major religions are patriarchal, male-dominated, male supremacist religions, and this continues to be a problem in this society and contributes to the fact that these mass killings are done by men. The 75% figure is fairly close to the percentage of adult white or European-American folks in the United States. So this is, as you stated quite well, most European Americans in the United States are middle class, and So this idea that somehow these mass shooters don't have fathers or whatnot, I think, is not founded in social science. The statistics don't bear this out.
Hmm. Well, Paul, I mean, whether we're talking about the military-industrial complex and the amount of money that is made by selling weapons to countries around the world, or we're talking about the U.S.'s domestic gun industry, there is a lot of profit to be made. Tell me about that profit aspect. Do you think that that adds to the overall problem of violence in the society, those that are profiting from this business? Do you see that playing into it at all?
Actually, some of the gun producers, as opposed to major missile systems, some of the gun producers have been facing bankruptcy and been in terrible financial problems recently because of liability suits against them, where people are suing, saying, well, you're to blame that someone used your product to shoot me. And so it has not been that profitable at the individual handgun level, as opposed to what you're talking about, the major missile systems and so forth used in our endless wars for Israel.
Uh-huh. So you don't think that that plays a role. What about you, Michael? Do you see that playing a role in it at all, the profit factor?
I do. We know from political science research that Congress, in particular at the national level and even at the state levels, are largely pass legislation and budgets that are influenced by big money more than by people power. And the gun industry has been very effective, both directly and indirectly through the NRA and other groups that it funds, to have very strong representation there to stop any gun registration that we wouldn't want to have in this country, or other kinds of things to limit assault weapons, assault weapons and things of that nature. So there's no doubt that profit is a big driver. It's also a big driver for the military weapons industry in the United States and is around the world, whether it's Israel, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, and whatnot. We have lots of gun, big gun producing profit motive things. And many of these countries I've just named are not members of the Arms Trade Treaty. They're not members of the Cluster Munitions Treaty. They're not members of the Landmine Ban Campaign. So we really have a lot of outlaw countries that are helping push weaponry at the war-making level as well.
Paul, do you think by limiting the number of weapons in the U.S. that it would make a difference? I mean, if there were laws that could be passed, perhaps, I don't know, banning automatic weapons or other type of weapons, would it make a difference or not?
No. I'm in California, where we have some of the strictest gun laws, and yet we have the mass killings. The reason for the recent increase in gun sales is because Biden became president. You have the defund the police people in this country, the Democrats who campaign on that, and at the same time are financed by people who, for example, the head of Facebook spends tens of millions of dollars a year on personal security for himself, whereas he contributes money to defund the police organizations. What are you going to do? People see that and they say, oh, no police. I've got to protect myself. You can't wait for the police to come. You'll be dead by that time.
Hmm. Michael,
this is where American kind of supremacist views is coming back to bite us, because most of the countries of the world are not suffering from this problem to the degree that we are. And all we need to do is to look at countries with similar cultures and similar back setups and see how they've managed this problem. And they've managed it quite well. But unfortunately, in the United States, we're not really willing to learn from other countries. We just think we're the best and don't want to learn. Whether it's our failure to get some sort of national health care that all the other rich countries of the world have done, or whether it's trying to handle gun pollution, that, for example, Australia and New Zealand have done extremely well by banning all kinds of guns and making great restrictions on all kinds of guns. And so there are things that we can learn from other countries. And if our country is to thrive and move forward, we need to learn, look around the world, see what's working, and try out some things that our neighbors, even look to our north, to Canada. What are they doing that's working well?
Well, Paul, how does this violence in general affect the psyche of the people in the United States when they're worried about sending their kids to schools or going to church or just going out shopping?
Absolutely. I live in Orange County, California. I live in Irvine, which has one of the lowest crime rates in the whole country, and people live in this pretend land that they think the rest of the country is that way. But even recently in Orange County, we have had gangs going into the most famous shopping malls, such as South Coast Plaza, stealing from the most expensive stores in front of everyone, no security guards stopping them, and not much worry throughout most of California about ever being prosecuted, because the Democrats pushed through laws saying that if you steal less than $995, there's no big deal. And saying that the employees cannot try to apprehend anyone, it's got to be a security guard, and the security guards aren't armed. Even the people who live in this cozy little pretend world, there's no problems, are now seeing it very frequently in the major shops, the crimes going on because of the Democrats.
Isn't that also part of it, Paul, perhaps the difference, the big difference between the haves and the have-nots that have become extremely, extremely a large gap, especially after COVID? We saw that the percentage of profit that the 1% gained during those couple of years and the majority of the people have gotten poor. I mean, do you think that that plays into it at all, because we're talking about societal problems, or not?
Absolutely. Many of the people involved in these crimes say, this is not a crime, this is a redistribution to me. It's been stolen from me, and this is reparations for me. It's time to give it back to me.
Well, Michael, what do you think needs to happen in general? Because with the deterioration of safety and security in the United States, I mean, it's problematic for everyone there. So what do you think needs to happen?
Well, what needs to happen is we need to see significant efforts, particularly at the national level, but also at the state levels, to reduce the amount of weapons in our society and I can be very specific. We can ban automatic weapons. We know that mass shootings went down when we first banned them in the 1990s. We should probably have guns. Gun registration should be required for gun owners. We should probably treat guns the way we do cars, so that if you own a gun, you have to pay insurance. Because we know that most guns that people have in their homes, and most people guns that have, don't end up being used against others or whatnot, but they get used within the family or within the home. Remember, we have an enormous suicide.